Unpack your knives and stay. Yes, stay. Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Podcast Wars, where myself, Haley Strong, Emily Fox, and Antonio Mazzaro will be facing off against Josh Wigler, Kirk Clark, and Mike Bloom in the ultimate test to see who comes out on top as the best podcasters in the land.
Oh, dang. I didn't know we were doing this.
Pressure.
Haley, as the one who announced the podcast, is there any reason why you shouldn't be the one to go should you lose the Podcast Wars?
I get it. I'm the least skilled person here by far. But I'm going to blame Josh. He's the one who should be leading the... Wait, no, he's on the other team. No, you know what? You're right. I should go. I absolutely should be the one to go.
You know, I think everybody always admired those captains who hopped off the ship shortly after trying to throw one of their crewmates off the ship. Those are always the most virtuous captains there in the world.
They go down in history.
Yeah, they really, really do. I noticed that we're all laughing and having a great time except for poor Uncle Tonio, who seems to just still be traumatized with everything that happened in Restaurant Wars. I've been very nervous about this podcast all week long since finding out what happened in Restaurant Wars, because I know that this is gonna land poorly for you, my friend Antonio. How are you doing? You okay? Are you all right?
Hey, I'm so happy to have Last Chance Kitchen, baby.
I forgot to watch Last Chance Kitchen. Damn it.
Oh, no.
Oh,
no.
My favorite show. Don't spoil it for me. I'm going to hop off. I'll go watch it real quick.
But they should call it Last Chance Kevin now, because that's all Antonio's investment is in right now.
Last Chance Kevin.
Hondo. Yeah, it was, of course, we saw the week before when we talked about on the podcast last week about the possible chicanery that could emerge from this concept-based It's Going to Be Yours challenge. Obviously, there's a lot to unpack with the choices that were made. With Restaurant Wars as a concept, I was looking back through some of my notes from our previous seasons of podcast, 4 and 5 seasons ago, us talking about what's wrong with Restaurant Wars. Does it need to change? What do we need to do? And we've seen in the years since, I think, a lot of different types of concepts. We've podcasted about them doing a lunch service and a dinner service. Last year, it was early. Now, this year, it is somebody carrying their own concept through and making choices, but putting that in an all-stars season. And we see two very different choices here from Kevin and Gregory, how they treat their fellow all-stars in terms of their contributions to the restaurant. And I think we see how that played out. So I don't know that it's a good thing the way that it played out, regardless of the results. Leave the results out of it, that we see all-star chefs being reduced to essentially just rote roles where they don't have input on the dishes. But on the flip side, the restaurant that let the chefs control the menu is the one that suffered the most for that decision.
I will say there's a difference there. And the only difference I find is that Southern cooking, I feel like, is a more understood topic than Haitian cooking. So it made sense for me for Kevin to let people do a little bit more with their dishes, where Gregory kind of had to be like, sorry, this is what you've got to do because you don't understand Haitian cooking like I do. Where we could see where the other chefs been like, well, I've dabbled in Southern cooking. It may not be my forte, but I have done it before.
That's fair. And I agree. And I think that's a good observation. And yet when they bring out the canapes, the first thing Tom says is none of these read Southern to me. So even if that were true, which it is, letting them have an input on there did not seem to be successful, despite the fact that they may understand Southern cooking and despite the fact that Kevin may try to explain it to him. It didn't work right from the jump. It didn't work. And I failed on that part of the concept. So I don't know. I completely agree that there is a difference there, but that doesn't mean that Kevin couldn't have shut it down the way Gregory did. He absolutely could have. And he didn't. And he went home for it. And that... He went home for being a stand-up guy. He went home for a lot of things. He went home for his own choices. It was the right thing to do, I think, to send him home. It doesn't mean I'm happy about the way that it all played out.
Yeah. It was tough. It was also one of those things where I think as soon as Country Captain started like tailspinning after like they had visited Gregory's restaurant, it was very clear that they were going to lose. And it was very clear to me for like a solid 20 minutes that we were watching Kevin go home. Right. To the point where like they and like I get why they did it in the moment. It's like, you know, if it's such a foregone conclusion, why even send everybody back to the stew room? But the way that like the episode structured out, the way that it like arced out where like it cut to commercial with Kevin like explaining what went wrong instead of like sending them back to the stew room to make the deliberation. I think at that point, like it was like very clinched to me, like, OK, so Kevin's going home. They're not even sending them back to the stew room. So it was, I guess, like it lacked a certain amount. It lacked a certain type of tension and drama, and instead had a very different type of tension and drama, which was wholly unpleasant to experience, especially as it pertains to a character this season who I've greatly, greatly, greatly enjoyed. So it was rough AF to watch for sure.
And correct me if I'm wrong, in some of the previous seasons of Restaurant Wars, the judges have split up to go to the different restaurants versus all going to one and then all going to the other. Is that correct?
In some previous ones? Like ships in the night. It's like I feel like
it's happened, but it doesn't happen as often as they all go together.
No, because they like to do a big thing about like the judges are coming. Like this is for the judges instead of it would feel weird to sort of do that twice. I think they did it during the probably the two service one in California, as Antonio was mentioning.
Okay, it's something that I may go back and look, because I think the Kevin's restaurant was put, it was kind of a compounded issue there in terms of, you know, I think if the judges come earlier in the service, things aren't necessarily as hectic and you're going to get a better service. But at the same time, even though there was a lot going on, it didn't seem like the complaints that the judges had against Country Captain were that your restaurant isn't running efficiently. It seemed to be more issues with the, you know, their actual specific table experience. But I'm wondering if that impacted things at all in terms of the judges coming at the point where it's a huge line of people. They're trying to get all these dishes out and then the judges are there. So they're in the middle of consuming food during a really hectic experience as well. I'm sure that wasn't in total what happened, but I'm sure that contributed somewhat to the outcome.
Listen, I'll just say it. I thought this episode sucked. For the reasons that Josh said, I think I don't know if you could have swapped the order out of order to have Country Captain go first, but I think Josh made a great point when you see the A student that was Khan, the Haitian restaurant, do so well. You're like, well, we're just about to watch 20 minutes of a restaurant downfall. And we talked about this, you know, I think with some of the confrontations a few episodes ago, like I'm fine with like drama in Restaurant Wars, but I feel like this was just so one-sided, probably the most one-sided we've seen since that aforementioned California season when you had Philip just like part of that group that just completely ran itself into the ground, and it's not fun to watch,
you know,
in my opinion.
Mentioning Philip, did anyone see Philip in the background at one of these restaurants? I saw it in the trailer and then I didn't see it in the episode, but I'm pretty sure I saw it in the trailer, and if that's true, then they had Philip at one of the restaurants and they gave him zero screen time, and that's hilarious.
And Mike, when you say this episode sucked, I'm going to internalize that as you did not enjoy this episode. Is that because of the structure of Restaurant Wars, or because of just like the series of events that just happens in the kitchens? Like, was it the structure that you didn't like, or was it the series of unfortunate events?
Both. And I think when it comes to the structure, I want to go back a bit to the previous episode, and I think it made me realize that as much fun as the previous challenge was, I think the decision to have the winning two restaurants be the ones leading Restaurant Wars was a poor decision completely, because I think you're essentially putting half the cast in line cook roles that really did not have too much input. And so that really is like putting them in an extremely safe position. Even Brian Voltaggio is like, all right, guess I'm stepping back and I'm a line cook this round. And while they did provide fun talking heads, I found there was no reasonable way that any of the four of them had any chance of going home this episode. And that sucks. You know, I think that for All Stars, especially, everyone should sort of get a chance to shine. And I think because the structure of the restaurant was Gregory and Kevin are leading this by default, it's their babies, then it's going to fall onto them unless some fluke thing happens. I mean, flat out, when Tom asks Kevin, okay, is there any reason why we shouldn't get a review? That's when I realized it was a terrible decision for them to have Gregory and Kevin lead the restaurants, because when your problems come down to the restaurant and the restaurant concept is from one person, in previous Restaurant Wars, everyone brews up the experience together.
Right.
Here, it's all on one person. So there is a next to nil chance that anyone sans Gregory or Kevin was going home. And so essentially, in winning the challenge last time, you gave yourself at least a 50% chance of going home in the next challenge, which I feel like is just not good from a structural perspective.
It's like sudden death Restaurant Wars.
Exactly. It's like, hey, congratulations for doing this. By the way, now you just put your head out on the chopping block that has a half and half chance of getting chopped off next round.
I kind of thought Karen was going to go home.
Yeah, I thought maybe.
Well, and there's certainly an argument that maybe she could have deserved to go home. And I'm not, I think the right person went home. So I don't want to say anything untoward, but thinking about the California season when they do the two services, one of the ways that Marjorie crushes it and helps Isaac, who wins the episode as executive chef, is that when she notices there's a problem with turning tables, she basically rips the people out of their seats. And she says, do you mind? Thank you guys so much for joining us. I'd love to give you a complimentary sparkling wine if you'd come over here and join us. And she pulls them out of the app, basically off the table, and busses the table herself and clears it out for the judges. And we don't see that in the captain in the restaurant with Kevin and Karen. We see the judges commenting. These tables aren't being bussed. It isn't just that people aren't leaving, but that's also part of it. All of that falls on front of house. Now, I think Karen was rightfully concerned about a lot of other issues, and one of which was that she had her own dish that she was responsible for. We didn't see Brian losing his mind and running back and forth to the kitchen a ton and really having the problems. And I don't think it was because Brian is somehow constituted better than Karen. I think it's that Brian had less responsibility in the challenge. He was basically just executing the dish Gregory told him to execute. So guess what? If it goes wrong, that's Gregory's fault. It's not Brian's fault. Brian had very little to do with it. Brian was roasting the fish. Who we saw roasting the judge's fish was Gregory. Like, Gregory took all of the tasks on himself and basically said, if this fails, it's going to fail because of something I did. I think Kevin's is a lot more indirect. The something he did was his choice to let everybody else have a role in what was going on. He let Melissa, as we see in the car, talk about maybe not having a second course and just doing three courses. What that meant was a whole lot more side dishes with the country captain dish. And as a result, we had a lot of issues with timing and preparation. If that had been done differently, maybe we don't have that problem. Maybe we don't have the problem with Karen being more concerned about what's going on in the back, or not having the time to properly train the staff, not having the time to do a lineup and have the staff taste the food. If she had been out in the front of the house working in the restaurant instead of in the back worried about her mushroom dish. And again, that's because Kevin gave her the latitude to be worried about the mushroom dish. So these are all Kevin's choices. And I think Kevin owns that when he says at the end, like, I could have stepped in at any point. I didn't think that was in the spirit of Top Chef for me to just take over and run this thing the way it was being run. And I think he's right about that in the spirit of Top Chef, but he's especially right about it, like you guys are talking about, Mike and Kurt, with regard to All Stars, right? Because on All Stars, you want to give these people their own platform. These are incredibly, Karen's James Beard, like these level of chefs, these people should be cooking their own food. They should have an input on this. They should not just be automatons that are carrying out your menu and doing it the way you said. That said, Mike, as you're saying, the way the challenge was designed basically ensured that if you don't treat it that way, you're going to go home if you lose. And that's exactly what happened. So I agree, Haley. Like, I thought because of the edit, which is a very interesting thing, considering, Josh, what you're saying, by the end of the episode, we're watching the last 10 minutes knowing it's going to be Kevin. And yet throughout, they're showing us Karen's failures and there's no drama in who goes home. It is very clearly Kevin. So it was very interesting that they chose to show a lot of these issues that Karen was having in light of the fact that they didn't then trade on those issues when it came to the big moment of who's going to go home. It was so clearly Kevin. So I think there were a lot of failures of Karen. I think we see that when we look at previous restaurant wars, how other chefs have handled the very problems that she struggled with. But a lot of the problems she was having were problems that Kevin let her have. So in my mind, the right person went home. It felt terrible to see. I also feel like Kevin's getting a little bit of hate online, and I don't like to see that.
Oh, really? What's going on there?
People talking about the very complex, and Emily, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this cultural situation that was in play here. We joked a little bit about it last week, that when you have a restaurant that's talking about the history of the spice trade and talking about the port of Savannah, and another restaurant that is focusing on like native Haitian cuisine, there's very naturally going to be a lot of complicated cultural issues there. Kevin has talked a little bit on Twitter for some of the people that are coming at him over this, that he talked extensively about that in the preparation of the restaurant with the other people that were preparing the food. We just didn't see it in the episode. I think seeing his integrity that we saw in this episode, I think we can probably recognize that that's true. Like that he wouldn't say that he did that. And he's not the kind of guy that would be co-opting other people's food or doing things like that. Like he's certainly aware of it. But
it would be a very disappointing surprise. Like that would be very out of character with everything that we have ever seen from Kevin as a character on Top Chef. You know, like that just does not align. Right. I believe in Kevin Gillespie.
Yeah. Emily, what do you think about the cultural aspects of this? I mean, food tells a cultural story so significantly. I feel like Gregory got a lot of credit for doing that in his restaurant. Kevin's was a little bit more all over the place in terms of that. But there are certainly those issues here that maybe we didn't really get into in this episode for focus on the drama instead.
Well, he both in the last episode and then this previous episode says, you know, this was the first taste of curry for most Americans. But that is so clearly linked to the spice trade and to slavery and to everything that, you know, we've been talking about, even with Eric and sort of his conceived ideas and themes that he's worked on. So I don't know. It's a sordid, complicated history of food culture in the South. We all know that. All of the things that are typically considered Southern cuisine are deeply steeped in the complex and really hard truths that go along with slavery. We can't diffuse the two. There's no way of, you know, separating one from the other. That's just the way that this is going to be. But that doesn't speak to any less of like what, you know, ultimately Kevin's trying to do here, which is to honor his grandmother, honor the dishes he grew up eating. You know, and I think that comes across very obviously in his intent that, you know, I want to make sure I'm serving all of these different dishes. My grandmother said, I got to go all in. You know, I can't let people not have these certain things. You know, you got to serve everything, everyone. He's so particularly even precious about the banana pudding, which is so unfortunate to watch.
God, know? Antonio, I'm yeah, let me just say, like, you were a prognosticator of so much stuff last week. One of them being that restaurateur Kevin is a giant douche. This is a microcosm of the restaurant. Just all fluff and no substance. Just like, shut up! Take your stupid $1,200 haircut back to your 30 restaurant to get the hell out of Restaurant Wars, Kevin.
Wow, haircuts really do cost $1,200 now, too. It's like either they're free or they're four figures.
Well, I wanted to know, like, who's going to be the first jerk that's like, where's the oxtail? And I was like, oh, I thought to myself, like, the person who's gonna go hard on this is probably Tom. Like, it's one of those like CJ with the burger and the pickle kind of things where you can either hear Tom saying it or he says the exact opposite. There's no middle ground. And of course, restaurateur, like replacement level white guy, comes in and says, I wanted to know where the oxtail was. And then in Kevin's restaurant, he's like, well, the problem with a restaurant that you build around one dish is if it goes poorly, then it all goes wrong. It's like, wait a minute, you wanted the oxtail, you fuck. Like, I don't get this.
I hated it.
The restaurant wasn't named oxtail.
Good point.
And I hated the judgment of, and I'm sorry I'm being so harsh here, because again, there was some fun stuff in this episode, but like when the judges walk in, they're like, well, this place seems too feminine.
I was so mad about that. That was annoying.
On his grandmother. Like, did you expect
poster board too? That had like floral wallpaper last week. Like, what
and Symphony
we
Eyes are being like, oh, look at this Miami Vice. But like, did you guys want Cracker Barrel? Because it sounded like they just wanted Cracker Barrel.
I thought the menus were nice, and I thought the font choice was like nice. Maybe they just loved Gregory's story on the back of the other menu so much that it was. I personally liked all of the choices, but I am sitting here in my very pink office. Like, that's my taste. I like the florals. I like the light blues, the pinks, and I thought it was nice.
I would have loved the Country Captain shirt in that font. It would have been awesome.
Yeah,
totally cool. Buy that shirt. You buy a shirt at every restaurant we go to.
I know.
Are you my dad? Because he absolutely does that as well.
Josh is actually your
Hard Rock
dad,
Cafe,
Haley.
Yeah. Orlando.
We brought
Rock
everyone
Cafe.
Here today to announce that Josh, you are the father of Haley Strong.
This is a great moment.
Haley's got the vapors.
My Restaurant Wars menu is going to be in Comic Sans whenever I get that point.
No, mine's going to be in
Kurt, we're no writings. Longer friends.
Entirely in Papyrus.
Yeah.
Did Kevin not benefit from writing a sonnet about Country Captain, his grandmother, much like Gregory did with Khan?
My captain.
Roses are red, violets are blue. Welcome to Country Captain. Eat my food. That's what I <heard. laughs>
There was something going on there. If you go back and watch, you can see in the plates, like some of the plates have pieces of paper on them that say like Huckleberry Finn or Mark Twain or something. Does anyone else see this?
I thought they were just dish descriptions that they left over or something.
Yeah, I do not make this up.
This is my grandmother's favorite books.
Yes. Dear Lord, they all have.
I don't know. These book recommendations are too feminine to me, too elderly, as if it came from somebody's grandmother. I don't understand it.
I hate grandmothers.
So how about this for a twist for Restaurant Wars? What if instead of Kevin and Gregory, it was Leanne and Stephanie? So Eric goes home, say, okay, here are the two losing concepts that are still in the game. It's up to you as a team to make these work.
Ooh.
I like that better.
I like that. That's sort of like a chef queer eye of like, here's, you know, some defunct restaurant concepts. Make them into something fab.
Who would be the judges on Chef Queer Eye, Mike?
It's got to be Anthony, now that he apparently knows how to cook.
You mean Anthony?
Who was it? Was it Ted? The guy who
Ted
does all the Food Network stuff.
Yeah, Ted Allen.
Ted Allen was the original one. I feel like you have to include Arnold from the DC season because he was like that very much like
definitely
fun.
You meant Schwarzenegger, which would have been cool.
I don't think you bring Arnold Schwarzenegger in, but it seems like he's hoarded himself in with all of his ponies.
Does it have to be men, or can we bring in Jamie from season 5?
Who in the kitchen is being the chopper?
Send it back.
Help me wipe.
Listen, they're in California. Why did they not enlist Arnold Schwarzenegger for one of these challenges?
It's not a tuna.
Wow.
Nailed it, Kurt. There's no heightening that.
Good.
Killed it. I don't think the judges were to blame. I mean, the judges are not a fault. I really like your idea, Kurt. This is the thing. We will opine on this consistently. We're here as a podcast. That's what we do. But we will constantly say, how can they change Restaurant Wars? Can they improve it? Does it need to be made better? How do you fix it? Is it broken? Like we've been saying, as I said, go back. We've been saying it literally for at least 6 seasons at this point. Every season that we've podcasted about, we've talked about it. This felt particularly egregious because it was on an All-Stars season and because of the way it played out, where one chef made a choice to let the All-Stars show their stuff and the other chef did not. And the chef that did not, the chef essentially who made worse TV, was the chef who won. The chef who made theoretically better TV was the chef who lost. And I'm not sure that the clash of those two things, it's always where in our reality TV watching, we have these problems, right? When Survivor chooses to add advantages to the game, not because they might make the game more interesting to play or to watch, but because they'll make a good TV moment. Like that maybe isn't the best calculus when you're planning how to do these things. And yet, that is the calculus primarily as TV producers, which is what these people are, that they have to undergo when they make these choices. So we knew last week that this was doomed as a concept, that this was putting these two people right there in the crosshairs, and that's what we got. And
one-on-one Top Chef.
Yeah, ultimately we got it, Top Chef duels. We got it because one chef chose to not let All-Stars be All-Stars. And not entirely, right? Because Brian Mularkey still got to be Brian Mularkey.
Yeah. How did you feel about him being the first pick for Gregory?
I was hurt and offended until Gregory was like, you are front of house, like don't come near my kitchen.
Yeah. Have you seen him actually? Because I saw his name attached to the fish, and that's the only name he, like, did we see him doing anything in the kitchen the entire episode?
I mean, he was doing, like he was doing his own little soundtrack, right, and Stephanie shut him up. But otherwise, yeah, I mean, and I think that's another reason why he got such a jump on Karen, is because he's like, great, I did this one thing. Gregory has, you know, his hands full and then some. Let me go work on training the staff. And it didn't seem like, it's still, you know, when it came to the con stuff, I guess the only big drama was like stuff with the servers. And I couldn't tell if the server disputes were coming from Leanne, who admittedly did have a bit of a rougher treatment of the servers, which prompted Stephanie taking over, or if it was from Mularkey training them incorrectly. Like I wasn't sure who should take the blame there.
Can I stand up for servers? So I have been working in the food industry on the front end for a long time now. I have made my career in events and hospitality. The career is not working out currently. So if anyone is hiring freelance, call me. But I feel like the servers get a lot of shit in these Restaurant Wars episodes, and a lot of the anger gets taken out on them. And that's true in real restaurants as well. The servers are the in-between. They get shit from the customers and also the kitchen staff. I worked this winter on a dining experience right down by the falls, where every weekend we had a different restaurant come in and cook. And so we had a completely different serving staff. So trying to get a serving staff that has never worked in an experience like this before, trained in one evening is so difficult. And you find what works and what doesn't, and you are able to work that out and evolve your strategy and work with different restaurants and figure out what works best for them. That's not possible in restaurant wars. And yeah, of course, people aren't going to remember every single dish on the menu, especially if you have Country Captain where they have like 400 sides, like, or the host being like, oh yeah, which table is this? Like, you're trying to get somebody to remember your weird table numbering schematic mm-hmm. in one evening. Mm-hmm. Like, there's reasons why servers, when you get hired at a new restaurant, doesn't matter how long you've been serving for, you are in training for a couple weeks.
Yep.
Because it takes a while to learn this stuff. And you can't, like, that's a function of Restaurant Wars. You have to deal with the fact that servers aren't going to know everything right off.
And every single season, it's like always that same drama. It's like, oh god,
they don't know the table numbers. Like, no, there's 20 tables.
The table got set up three hours ago.
And
there's expediting issues in every single restaurant in every single season of Restaurant Wars. I think anybody who's at any managerial
issues in every single evening at every restaurant. Yeah. That's just restaurants, and you have to learn how to deal with that as a cook, as a chef, mm-hmm. as a restaurant owner, as a server. And that's why servers make the best customers at restaurants, because they're always like, oh yeah, sure, like, no problem. You know, like, servers are trying their best, okay?
It's a great take, because I think, like, another complaint about Restaurant Wars systemically within Top Chef is that it's like every season villainizing a section of the restaurant industry that doesn't deserve that.
They get paid less than everyone else there. I'm sorry. Like, they're, you want these like teens who are making $3.25 an hour to be like, no, they're top level Haitian food. Like, I'm sorry. Yeah. Like, that's just not happening.
I wonder if anybody, and the answer is probably yes, but I wonder if anybody actually views the episode through the lens of, oh, these servers are horrible, versus like every time, maybe it's just because I've watched a lot of reality TV or because I've managed things even outside of a restaurant before, but it's like, I watch this episode and I don't see that as the fault of the servers. I see that as...
A lot of people just think servers are idiots. That's the thing. That's like, people will look at servers and think that they're dumb.
I'm wondering, I've gotten that a million times before. Like, I just haven't followed it along. I haven't followed social media in terms of Restaurant Wars. And it's like, I watch this and I see it as a function of the situation. Restaurant Wars just got on. And also how the chefs train, the minimal training they have, that falls on the chefs. It's
Kurt,
it's
you like, have to remember you're sensible and not everyone else's.
No one's accused me of that before.
And like, something else I noticed with Kevin's restaurant, they were having issues in bussing. Well, they needed their entire serving team to bring out the dishes, right? So if you're bringing out an entire table's 45 plates at once, and you have to go back and keep doing that, it's hard to bus your tables. It's very difficult when you're trying to run on that time. And I'm sure for the most part, these tables are coming in at 15-minute increments, and there's probably like three or four tables sitting at once. It is hard to have four tables sit at once and be able to like get through it.
Yeah. And I'll speak to the line cook side of that too. Like, I've done events for, you know, the last, you know, couple of months where it's all weddings and it's all the same servers that we all know and love. And maybe the configuration is slightly different. And there's always confusion. There's always something happening. There's always a last minute switch because some little kid is there and needs to eat buttered pasta instead of like the main entree. And we didn't find out until 2 seconds before we plated everything.
Or we have to
refire a million things. Or, you know, even to Gregory's point where he's trying to cook the fish and Malarkey's going, come on, man, come on, this is for the judges. And he goes, no, I'm sorry, I need 2 minutes to really finish this. Like, that happens all the time where you're like, I'm not going to serve them raw fish. Like, this needs to be perfect. You're going to have to wait another minute and a half before you can bring it out.
And at least Restaurant Wars specifically, this again, from my recent memory of this season and last season, is whenever there is a service issue, Top Chef, I think, again, just based on these most recent two seasons, does a good job of using it not to highlight how poor the service is, but how the chefs react to it. And that's,
definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that's very important. Everyone's been in these high stress situations. If you work in a restaurant, you get it. This episode, like, it was hard for me to watch because it's like every event and restaurant anxiety dream I've ever had, like on screen for me to see.
Yeah.
Same. Like when you work in this industry, and I'm sure you get in other industries, you have dreams where you're running to every table and you can't get to anything. And I'm sure the same is for you, Emily, where you're trying to cook dishes and you just can't catch up.
Josh can speak to this. When I first started my job, working as, an events, you know, sort of back of house, professional, I don't know, a line cook, basically, I would jump out of bed in the middle of the night thinking I needed to get to something.
I can't believe you just confessed on a podcast that you and I sleep together.
Does Emily even know
that she has a daughter named Haley Strong?
When I used to go to tables and like tell the specials, like a lot of the time, like I would just like run it off, and like because it's so ingrained in my head, people would be like, oh, like you do that so well. And I would joke, oh, like I say it in my sleep. And the one time Ethan was like, Haley, you were taking orders in your sleep last night.
Yeah. That begs the question then, and I guess, you know, pulling the two people on the panel, is Restaurant Wars like your least enjoyable traditional episode of Top
I hate Chef? It. I hate watching it because it's not, it doesn't,
interesting.
It, because like, sure, it's like a restaurant and they should be able to do this, but this is not how a restaurant is. Like, you get more time, you have time to find, you hire your own servers, you don't just like get given servers.
Yeah. And like, of course Karen spilled the wine, she's like all amped up, like,
yeah,
you know,
she was losing it.
I know. And how does your adrenaline not just like,
yeah. And I've been in Karen's spot where you have to set up like 25 tables by yourself. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Like, totally. I've been there. I have done that. I have lifted the tables. I have set every single table and like just hoped that I would finish it before the bride and groom got there, kind of thing. Yep. You know what I mean? Like,
absolutely.
And you're doing it in heat, and you're doing it like in the morning and like at night. And, you know, these event days, like, I'm sure they did this too. Like, they're 16 hours.
Yeah.
Like, nonstop. You don't sit.
Yeah. You pee maybe once at the end.
but you can't even pee because you didn't drink all day, so it's just like,
yeah, exactly.
You're
I'm so crystals. Dehydrated during this. Yeah, absolutely.
I did, what did not you think just, we would just end say? Up here peeing out crystals.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, okay. Yeah. Oh, is that what you use?
Yeah. Yes.
Stick a fork in it. We'll be right back after these messages, and take that fork right out because we're back.
So then, let me ask you, Haley. So, what was your take then on what we saw of the way Leanne was handling Expo? Like, do you think it was the right call to switch over to Stephanie? Was it so like egregious of the way Leanne was handling that situation?
I wouldn't say it's egregious because I get how Leanne got into that emotional spot. You just get so frustrated when you feel like you understand something and that thing should be clear to everyone, but it's not. And
story
it is
of
so
my life.
It's
that's
so
feeling
frustrating.
That transcends that specific job.
It's so frustrating when a plate goes to the wrong table because then the kitchen has to remake this plate, and then that pushes everything else back. So I understand why Leanne was frustrated, but it's hard to, as a server, come back from that, come back from being yelled at, to be able to trust the people in your kitchen. To kind of, and if you have another issue, you don't want to go back to them. And those issues need to be fixed. They need to be corrected. Because restaurants are like the, you know, like the duck analogy where everything's like chill on the surface, but like the little legs are going like this under the water. And like,
Malarkey
said,
right? Malarkey said what, like comforting chaos. They see comfort. I deal with the chaos in the back.
Exactly. He was spot on in that. So I think having Stephanie move over there, was the right call. And I'm glad that Leanne, just accepted it. And she was like, not the super pleasest about it, but she was like, okay, cool. Like, it's one thing off my plate.
Stephanie was like the star of this episode.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm fully team Stephanie now for the rest of the season.
And I will say, I love Stephanie and you know this, but I think she did so well because there was so little pressure on her.
Yeah. I mean, and that's a choice Gregory makes.
Yeah. And again, that goes back to like when you have line cooks and they're just given orders to like, hey, cook this food. And especially because they did not come up with the concept of the restaurant, it's very easy for them to be like, okay, I'm just going to make my food and I'm totally.
But she did it perfectly.
Yeah.
Like,
I
she
love
made,
that.
She
yeah.
put her whole heart into it. And a reason why I love Stephanie so much is because she is such a team player and she has so much respect for the people around her. And the way she took on the dishes that she did, I think just really shows how much she loves Gregory and loves this concept and really cares, because I feel like we've seen some line cooks in the past that are like salty that they weren't in the lead role. So that they don't put their all into it, where Stephanie just like put her whole heart and soul into this. And she made sure to check with Gregory to make sure, like, is this your vision? Because if not, we'll fix it. We'll figure it out.
I think, well, and she gets it. Go ahead, Josh.
No, go for it, Anthony.
No, I'm fine.
I think what's interesting to me is that there was like the baked in drama at the start of like the draft of like, I can't believe Gregory didn't pick Melissa. I can't believe Gregory picked Malarkey. And really, like the secret weapon in the end is that Gregory gets Stephanie as the final pick, right? And I think that the two of them work together really, really well. I think that Stephanie and Gregory, we've seen it already this season, the two of them in great concert together.
Literally.
Weren't they? Yeah, they were literally in the, oh, there's a good pun. Oh, the concert pun coming a couple weeks later.
And I love that Stephanie, like that we didn't like that we saw, did not react in a way that was like, I can't believe I was picked last. Like, this is such BS. Like, she was just like, I am so happy to be with Gregory again. Yeah. How wonderful.
Totally. And I think, I know we're talking a lot about how, like, was this like a restaurant wars that's fitting to the talents of the people, especially if it's all stars, why not give everybody a little bit more of a directive in terms of agency and free reign to do their thing. But the structure of the game is not the player's fault. That's something that falls onto the plate of the producers. And I think given the situation that they wound up in, I think, just over the course of this conversation, it's been maybe a little bit lost so far. Antonio, you've said a bunch of times, like, that's Gregory's choice. So I know that the recognition is there, but just to like put it more finely, like, I think that Gregory crushed this challenge.
Absolutely.
In the sense of like, he took it on. He had his vision. He helped people execute the vision. Malarkey, you are just like by name associated with the dish, but you're front of house. You know, Leanne, like, maybe struggles a bit. Stephanie is really empowered to crush this dish that Gregory has a real vision for, and she nails it. It seems like that was among the very best things that everybody ate. And I think Stephanie, like, is able to do so well in this episode because, like, there is a certain amount of pressure that's off. But I think what I also observe is that I think it empowered her to rise up to a moment of pressure when Leanne is crumbling with Expo, that Stephanie sees that, and Stephanie feels like the power within her, based on how things are going, based on her working relationship with the captain of the ship at this point in time, to be like, I'm going to take that over.
Yeah.
And like, that's a pressure roll. That's a huge pressure roll. 'Cause what if she steps in and F's it up? And she doesn't. So I think, like, I absolutely agree that I wish the challenge was better thought out for an all-star season. I think it really sucks that it ended up being, you know, one-on-one basketball, essentially, with like a fleet of three other chefs on each team, being, you know, in lower risk positions within the squad. That's absolutely not one-on-one basketball. But it's essentially like those two states.
One-on-one, but we each get three teammates.
We get three free teammates each. Oh, like, obviously. But like, the structure of it is so clearly like it's a death match. It's one-on-one. That sucks. But given that that's the structure, I just feel like Gregory deserves a mountain of kudos for handling that situation the way he does. It's very, very
completely.
Our boy Antonio is raising the finger.
I'm surprised they didn't like tell him, like, you obviously got the win. Like, here's an extra $5,000 or something.
I was going to say, I wonder what everyone thought about the fact that all four of them got the win. Granted, it does mean that finally someone besides Gregory, Melissa, and Kevin have won an elimination challenge. But it was sort of like, they occasionally do this, of like the team itself wins. But I agree, I was a bit surprised that Gregory himself did not get like a particular
trip somewhere,
like checking so many boxes.
How awkward is it that everyone gets an open table subscription to help their restaurant? And
it's Stephanie. Cool. Like, she's like, and I were discussing that, and we're like, she should get an extra like $2,000 or something.
Can she take the cash prize or give like that as a second year of somebody else's subscription?
Yeah,
right.
No, it's interesting. Like, I was like, if this basically does come down to, oh, now this is sudden death restaurant wars, and if the chefs acknowledge that, it's like, well, you know, odds are one of you is going home, then there needs to be something that I think like equally on the line for the potential winner. Like, you know what? Guess what, Gregory, you're now final four. I mean, that might be a bit extreme, but to extent like
Gregory, you mean, just won top. Anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
Gregory, get on a plane right now. You're going to Italy ahead of time.
Yeah, just hang out there, wait for us. So or something. But it's like you need to you know, better weigh that out. And I think written what you were saying, Josh, about like how, you know, Stephanie has stepped it up. I think one of the, you know, unintended or potentially intended consequences of the structure of Restaurant Wars this time is that, yeah, the menu is entirely Gregory's and Kevin's, and at least, you know, in Gregory's kitchen, Stephanie didn't have a lot of flexibility there in terms of the dishes, but I think that does allow, like, she now had that opportunity to see more like logistical and kind of, you know, process driven ways that she could help the kitchen out. So it's like, if I can't impact the dishes, where are the other places where I can impact things? So in terms of expediting, she saw this issue come up, and it was, I think, the perfect opportunity for her to step in and add a little bit of calmness to the situation.
It's Restaurant Wars in name, but in reality, what we saw was a lot more like finale style presentation, where it's 1v1 and it, like, we have all-star chefs performing in supplicant roles. And we don't see issues with expediting or things like that highlighted in the finale. Those get highlighted in Restaurant Wars because seemingly they're part of the equation and people occupy these roles, these traditional roles. And yet the traditional roles really didn't matter. Now, they mattered for, I think, who went home. But they didn't really matter because these people were never on the block, as you guys are saying. Yeah. And yeah, I mean, all the things that we all have said about how it matters that the servers come in and the servers are who they are. One of the things you deal with at Restaurant Wars is sometimes you're going to get servers who really are pro and who work pop-ups all the time and who understand like what they need to get right in their head immediately when they walk in the door and what they don't, or how best to roll with the punches. And some are fresher, greener, and haven't had an experience like this. And that's just the reality is sometimes you're going to get a service staff that has that experience, and that sometimes you have one that doesn't. Every one of these chefs has been on Top Chef before. So to berate or treat any of these service staff negatively is wrong. And I love that Stephanie stepped up and we saw a confessional from her saying, like, nope, 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 we don't do that. I think it's interesting, by the way, that we had it in the edit at all. Like, I know we needed to show, like, maybe there was some drama and there was a possibility that someone from Gregory's team could go home if they lost. Maybe it wouldn't be Gregory. But Top Chef chooses what they show us. Last year, they showed us the winner of Top Chef being shitty to the waitstaff. Like, that was a choice that they chose to make. And I don't know why, but that's something that made the show. And so we see what is there, but we see what they choose to show us. It's not like these people didn't behave that way, but we don't see if Leanne is apologizing to people a lot. We don't see if she talks to the servers after the service and says, sorry, I really got caught up there. We don't see that. We only see what we see. And as a result, people form opinions. And I think it's important to keep that in mind. As we're also keeping in mind the stress and the role of the servers in this, like, anybody that's being negative in these moments, like, it's just a moment and we don't really know what the full story is there. And speaking of the full story and not knowing it, yeah, like, Karen is setting that up all on her own. And we saw how that was different with Malarkey, that there were others, or Malarkey was out there on his own. Sorry. And Karen was not.
Yeah, Kevin was helping Karen.
Kevin was helping Karen. So there are these choices that are made that ultimately do impact the full service. And certainly, as I said, the big one that stood out to me is that Karen is back there in the kitchen for a much longer time, seemingly, than Malarkey was. And as a result, Gregory's team gets to do everything they need to do with the servers. They get a more extended training. They get to bring the servers back and have them taste the dishes and really talk about the expediting process. And it still goes poorly. It still goes poorly, despite the fact that they had all the time to do that. They still have hiccups. So there is no great way to do this. I think, Haley, you're right. Like, it happens. There are expediting issues in restaurants, never mind Restaurant Wars.
Every single night. Right. No matter what, the chefs could be there for like 15 years and there's still going to be an issue. Like, that's why you check your tickets. Like, you know, and something else I didn't really think about before now is that none of these servers have probably been on television before.
Yeah.
It's like they're in LA. They all want to be on TV. Like,
okay. Good point. Good point. Yeah.
Are you surprised that Philip didn't get up and start working on the staff?
I think I'm surprised he didn't try for sure.
Not enough rocks.
He could have pulled a drink out from underneath the host station.
And just, or he comes out with like a mustache on top of his mustache. Like, my name is Marcio. I'd like to be on your staff today.
Although the woman at the host station on with Malarkey for Gregory's restaurant, she looked really familiar.
Yes, she did. Who is she?
I don't know.
Okay, you've never been on television before.
I was like, man, I can't figure out why she looks familiar to me. I feel really like validated right now, Kurt.
Okay, good, good, good. Okay.
But going back to what Josh said a while ago, I just want to continue to heap praise onto Gregory, because I mean, this might be, I think just by proxy of the structure of this challenge, this is probably the most dominant restaurant work performance in recent memory, if not of all time, because he succeeded and on so many fronts.
In many ways, it just felt effortless. That speaks to what I was trying to hone in on last week with my thoughts on Gregory, is that like there's just a level of confidence to him where I think that he was just like cool as a cucumber.
If you could hug anybody on the cast, I think it would be him first.
Well, I'm not hugging anyone anymore. I'm done with hugs. Hugs are over. Hugs are canceled. But like I thought that the energy that he brought to it was just like very self-assured, very clear of vision. Literally like telling Malarkey right away when he's first round pick, like you're front of house. And like that's why he drafted him. He doesn't need him to touch food. You know, literally like you have to touch a plate so like, that
please
you know,
touch nothing.
Yeah, you know,
just like, stand in the kitchen. I have a question.
Malarkey, go
plates.
Yeah, I was gonna say go touch those other team's plates though. You can touch that.
That was some bullshit. That was crazy.
Do you think it was bullshit that like that Kevin and Karen were so mad, or you think it was bullshit that Malarkey chose those plates?
I think it was bullshit that Malarkey got to not only choose the plates but kept the plates. You take them. Like I'm just surprised that neither party was like, okay, we can have those plates back.
I thought both parties used the plates, is what I understood.
Yes.
I think that's what happened. I mean, Kevin and Karen pulled them down off the shelf and set them at a place setting to see how they would lay out, right? And then Malarkey stumbled upon the place setting and said, here's our plates.
But they weren't like standing. They weren't standing there. Like I've been to a couple of these decor showrooms where that's that they set those up so you can see it. So I have a hard time being mad at Malarkey for this. Right. As much as I would love to be mad at Malarkey for things, like I just don't think this is like one of those ones where he was being malicious at all. Like I've been to a bunch of these showrooms and they're set out like that. I could see him being like, that looks great.
Yeah.
But to your point, I can't remember if it was Antonio or somebody who said it, but I'm surprised that after it was called to his attention, that he didn't be like, my bad, you had them first.
But those were the best plates, allegedly.
Yeah.
Their owners fall on this restaurant supply plates of apparently they're being advertised as like only one good pair of plates.
We have this one entire depot. Set of plates that's worthwhile.
But I think those plates did work well with the feeling of both of those restaurants. And I think like I don't know if we it's not like we got anyone saying like, oh, I can't believe they use the same plates as the other restaurant. Like it's just that it matters. Like you don't notice
floor with Kevin.
Yeah,
you know, Mr. Kevin Rathbuncher was like, "I cannot believe they have the audacity to use the same plates, and these are way too feminine."
Kevin Gillespie when they were getting the plate, he just told Malarkey, "Yo, I licked that plate. Actually, that's mine." And then it's like, "Oh, it's all yours. Sorry."
And I went.
Yeah, but then people would be like, "We have hardcore dishwashers in the back. We'll just wash it in 3 seconds."
Yeah, and then Leanne starts yelling at the dishwashers for not getting them out in time.
Poor Leanne.
I did think it was.
I don't know. I'm sort of like I wouldn't say I'm over her, but like I'm my rooting interest in her is like just decreasing.
Michael.
Her teeth have a lot of skin. If you pick up like in terms of hanging on by the skin of her teeth.
Oh.
I was like maybe I need to connect.
Not
that
sure
thought.
Where you're going with that one.
Maybe I need to connect that thought.
I was like,
her's got those tiny teeth with those big old gums.
Her teeth are growing skin as we speak.
That was definitely the dot dot dot. I'm going to finish the thought and connect the dots for everybody because that was better said in my head.
Kurt, I really appreciate what you were going for though.
Thank you.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I think she's fine. I just think from like a personality perspective, I am not necessarily connected with her as much as I have everybody else in the final eight, including the contestant who was most recently eliminated. So it says probably more about me than it does about her. But
no, you're right.
Stop dragging my teammate.
I feel like we've been seeing
you were 3 weeks ago.
And it's hard for us to have a rooting interest in her.
She hasn't made Flounder, has she?
Wah, wah.
Shadoo. I love Leanne. If I was dragging her weeks ago, it was literally like, I'm so stressed out for you, and I just want to be put out of my misery. So just go home so that I feel less
stressed.
Josh
keeps talking about her like she's on her last legs as like the family pet or something.
As if that skin on her cheek is growing.
No, I said it when I drafted her. I've said it along the way. I've loved Leanne on my television for a very long time. I think that she's tremendous. I love the way she talks about food. I love the way she interacts with the camera. So all of that is still intact for me, except it's now paired with like she just has had these moments that have been less savory,
more sweet,
or bittersweet. You know, there's just been a lot of like, you know, strikeouts for her, and yet she's still hanging in there. So just the way that I engage television, that's stressful for me. But I still love Leanne. I would say on like a normal show, on almost any other show like this, I would say like the type of content we've been getting from Leanne would like rule her out. But also Chef Nicholas won Top Chef. So like, you know, like people who have had like harsher looks have gone on to win the show. And Kurt, I really don't mean that as an example to drag you. I literally mean that as in like we saw like some very unsavory moments with him along the way. So I wouldn't rule Leanne out. But I also think if you're not like a big Leanne person to begin with, the way that she's been coming across this season is not going to necessarily do you any favors in terms of a rooting.
And it seems like more and more, I've just like every time we see Leanne, there's some association with Malarkey. I mean, it was the episode where Malarkey was helping her like salt or undersalt or oversalt her dishes. And then they got paired up for the music challenge. Now they're on the same team here. It just seems like we're perpetually getting this strange Malarkey. Like if I had to talk about who's like the duo on the season, my first mind doesn't go to Gregory and Stephanie. It goes to Malarkey and Leanne.
Yeah, it feels like a very opposite end of the spectrum, having like Gregory and Stephanie who keep getting paired together and like Leanne and Malarkey who keep getting paired together.
And it doesn't help that like Leanne and Malarkey go together like skin and teeth. It's like a very stressful, uncomfortable fit. You know, it's an uncomfortable fit.
Prime sure. Malarkey is definitely teeth.
Yeah,
I hate this so. You guys have said a lot of weird stuff on the mm-hmm. podcast over the years, but that's the worst thing I've ever heard.
I want to quickly remark on this is only for the $50,000 patrons who can watch the video, and I know that's a
the ones out on my couch
right
over
now.
There.
But there was a moment just now. It's over where there was like some golden light falling on Antonio. There it is, and it just looks.
It's like a desk lamp.
It just looked incredible. It's neither here nor there, but I just wanted to bring it up.
No, it's here.
Yeah. It's here. It's not there.
Yeah. One of my favorite moments of the episode had nothing to do with skin or teeth, and it was not just that Gregory picked Brian second, but that Padma interrupted and said, can we just get some feedback on why that just happened?
let me float something out here. Padma like definitely hates Brian Malarkey, right?
Absolutely.
Like I feel like she absolutely like between like all the time she, I mean, maybe she admires the fact that they can have a bit of like rat-a-tat rapport back and forth, but I feel like she just has like a disdain for him so much so that to your point, she does break like the quote unquote professionalism to be like, okay, hold on for a second. Really? Yeah. Really? You picked Brian
like,
Malarkey?
Melissa's right there.
Yeah. Allow me to record scratch for a second.
Ethan and I have been watching this Guys Grocery Games tournament of stars or something like that, and Brian Malarkey is on it, and there's seven other contestants, and a storyline in both the episodes we have watched have been like, Brian Malarkey is so annoying, and one of the people commenting yeah like in one episode Alex Gernishelli is so annoyed with Brian Malarkey because her station's next to his and he's just like
all hands,
and then in another episode the challenge is like you have $36 for the day and there's two challenges and you can spend all your money in the first challenge if you want, but you won't have any money left if you're not in the top four. Anyways, so Brian was at the checkout and he was like so over, but then he would like pull radishes and like, you know, whatever. And anyway, then Marcel Vigneron, quite possibly one of the most annoying people on Top Chef ever, was like, oh, Brian Malarkey, he's so annoying. I was like, I am in some weird little vortex.
Yeah.
But I mean, I guess, you know, I think he worked really well for this challenge. Like, I think the fact that, like, he was dressed like beach dad, you know, complete with the rolled up pants, and he was wearing an apron despite working front of house for some reason. And
the whole staff was wearing aprons.
And so I think the aesthetic of the restaurant was built out, again, as much as they might make fun of the judges disparaging country captains aesthetic, maybe it's because the con aesthetic from the blue accent wall down to the aprons being worn by everybody had a clear POV, and it was done so well.
Is it worth asking if Kevin had taken Brian Mularkey first, does Kevin win Restaurant Wars?
Not necessarily, I don't think. No. I think it's a Gregory decision of how to utilize Mularkey.
And I think that because a lot of things we've been hearing about Mularkey is that he can't edit. So having somebody on your team who can't edit when you already haven't been able to edit what's going on, I feel like that's just like asking for trouble.
Yeah, he'd be like, you know what, Kevin, you should make 20 courses. I think you could like totally get that done. I've got a great idea for it.
So was there any saving Kevin's idea to let the chefs be the chefs? Was there any saving that? Or is that the single flaw?
Pairing down dishes. If they didn't have to make as many, I think it could have been smoother on a lot of
aspects. And that was the thing he wasn't allowing them input on was the structure. It was like you can let me help you make these, let me help you blend your ideas with this cuisine I'm thinking. But the structure, we can't touch it. This is how it's done.
It sure seemed to me like he was letting Melissa have input on the structure, Kurt, when they're in the car the first way through, when she is saying, I don't think we should do a second course. And Kevin's saying, well, if we're not doing a second course, we're going to have to do more on the third course, because the third course is just this country captain with a couple of side dishes. So if we're cutting out the second course, we're going to have to do more side dishes. Now, granted, that's him saying, I think the structure is going to have to change, but that's letting her have input on the structure, in my opinion. And I don't know that full conversation. We just saw a snippet of it, but it seemed like it was Melissa that was saying no second course. And I don't know. Gregory only did three courses too. And clearly he didn't do three courses in the way Kevin did. So I just don't know. I understand that I'm probably going to be on my own in this, but I don't know that the too many dishes were the failing. I think it's possible that they still could have executed how many dishes that they had. I think the problems were that they were too many dishes that people had too much input on. And then they didn't take the time necessary, maybe because they didn't have the time, but maybe they didn't have the time because people were so caught up in trying to develop these dishes instead of making things simple. Like Brian Voltaggio's dish was shrimp and grits, right? Or shrimp and creamed corn. But they commented on how it was essentially more of an entree dish. And Kevin said, like, when you're serving shrimp and grits or shrimp and creamed corn with the country captain like this, it's typically just a bowl of gravy, shrimp on top. Why let Brian be more, you know, to elevate this dish? And essentially, it's more like an entree. I guarantee you that if you could 86 the dish itself, sure, fine, that's better. But if we just made it like bowl of grits and shrimp, instead of an elevated Brian Voltaggio essentially making another entree, then maybe it goes better.
Yeah,
so I don't know. I don't know that it's because Kevin's team did what, 12 dishes? Is that right?
And there was the mushroom issue as well. I mean, yeah, there was. Yes.
Well, I know the cookery was just bad, apparently.
The mushroom issue was, again, you could deliver just something very basic there, but Karen's trying to do something a little more complex. And there were issues that I think she sort of overcared for it. Yeah. She would tell you that she undercared for it, but it was that she's so caught. It doesn't take a lot to make the relish that she made. That is almost a mise prep. Like, really, like she's just chopping a few things and combining them. The mushrooms were a little bit more of a prep. She's back there in the kitchen when she should be up in the, it's going to sound terrible. She should be focusing on the job that she was assigned the way Brian Mularkey did. Instead of being stuck in the kitchen, she's stuck in the kitchen because she feels she needs to execute her version of the dish, not because she has to execute a dish, period. How many dishes did Gregory's team do? How many? 10?
Let's count.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
8?
Yeah. 8.
Okay. So it was 8 versus 12. But one of the dishes of the 12 was with pickles, cucumbers. Yeah. I guess one of Gregory's was pickles. So I guess that's 1-to-1. Gregory's team did a salad. Kevin's team didn't. Like, I think that the conceptualizing the menu is a problem, but I do think that he let them have an input on the conceptualizing of the menu. So I think I don't know how he wins because his basic choice was to let them be chefs.
That was a bad choice.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
Yep. If you had chosen not to do that, I mean, I still think there's a world where their service goes better and they maybe can still win. His country captain was the big downfall, in my opinion.
Yeah, but that was my question for you.
Like, but that came from the fact that apparently the stuff he used last time wasn't there.
But it also came from a lack of time. He knew the day before that it was bad, but he says multiple times, I just didn't have the time to develop the flavors I needed to get it back to where it needed to be. I'm confident that a chef like Kevin of his caliber is not going to be undone because you give him like a different kind of curry powder. I am confident that he could have figured out how to make that dish work, but he just didn't have the time to do it. Now, granted, he didn't have the time to do it because they were doing a lot of other things. Mm-hmm. I understand that. But I think if the things had been simpler, you could still have done as many things. I think the problem was in part that they were doing these elevated versions of these dishes. I mean, this is not an attack on a cod patty. The patty, I mean, I had a lot of patties when I lived. I had a lot of them when I lived in South Florida. Jamaicans have a lot of them in their cuisine. I'm sure you guys have had them in New York as well. I know they're everywhere in certain parts of the city there. The pastry crust is everything. And I saw Stephanie working on that crust. I saw Gregory tasting it, telling her, this needs to do this. This needs to be better. I saw them working that out. Once you work that out, that's not a difficult dish to execute, period. I mean, it isn't.
I don't think what you're saying is offline or out of line, Antonio. Like you said, you thought you might be alone on it, that it wasn't the number of dishes that tanked him. I agree. I don't think it was. If there was very specific executional issues with many of the actual, you know, dishes that were served. I think if Restaurant Wars had been opened up to have, if you had diners attending both and they had to rate them comparatively, then I think their individual experience of wait times and food like not coming out quickly, that might have impacted it. But in terms of what the judges were judging on and the comments we heard, I think they commented on, yeah, well, these are tables aren't getting turned that quickly. But I think in terms of the substantial comments we saw that felt like they led to the conclusion of the episode, it was about the food. I agree 100% there.
I think it's telling, for example, you talk about those car conversations when Melissa is telling Kevin, I don't think we should do a second course. We should just do, you know, this. Leanne is giving her feedback in Gregory's car on dessert. And she's like, I can do pineapple ice cream, pineapple. And Gregory's like, rum raisin. You're doing rum raisin ice cream. Like, he basically tells her exactly what she has to do. And he shoots down her ideas and says, this is what you're doing. So,
but it was her idea for the pineapple upside down cake, was it not?
It was. But that happened to fit. For when ideas didn't fit, instead of letting the chef have the latitude to just make it their own, it seemed like Gregory said, no, this is what you're doing.
Well, because he was the expert in Haitian food.
Right. And Kevin is the expert in this particular restaurant concept, which is not just Southern food. It's Southern food of a particular time and place.
Right. When the first course that comes out of Country Captain is Dungeness crab salad with egg yolk pudding from, who else? Brian Voltaggio.
Yeah.
As much as I disparage Judge Kevin, I would agree with the comment of like, that does not scream Southern to me. Yeah. That screams Brian Voltaggio's take on Southern.
Right. And, you know, these chefs are all really talented. And I agree that they're more likely to have had experience with the generalized Southern cuisine than they are the generalized Haitian cuisine. But I do think that in general, Kevin's restaurant isn't just Southern. It's very specifically of a particular time and place. How much experience do they have cooking his grandmother's food? I think the answer is zero. I don't think they've cooked any of his grandmother's recipes. And so I think that's part of the problem is, and I think, Mike, you have expressed this to me in text, like it's just the design of the challenge. Like when you come in with a concept already locked because the concept was bought and sold in the previous challenge, then what you're essentially asking them to do is execute on one particular version of a concept. And it wasn't like Kevin's concept was New American or something so broad. It was so specific in his head of my grandmother's food and the country captain, this 1700 Savannah port spice kind of mixture. It was like a very niche version of Southern food that even when Brian Voltaggio and Melissa and talented chefs are taking a swing at it, they're not getting in the ballpark. And that's Kevin's fault, of course. But I think his last speech is basically like, the spirit of Top Chef is that I should have let these people be these people. I could have stepped in a lot and I didn't want to, I didn't choose to. So therefore I think I should go home. And I think he's right for that. I just don't know, other than changing his decision, is there a way to fix it? I think their service could have gone smoother if the if some of those chefs had realized the way Stephanie did, like, hey, I'm just going to execute on Kevin's vision. I'm not going to put my neck out there. I thought Melissa did a really good job in this episode of kind of staying out of the fire. Well,
I think she did a great job in that one moment where she was brought into the fire. She was dragged into the fire by Karen, who is
differing, right?
I was told that my dish would be finished. Yep. Apparently it wasn't. And it's like, ooh, this should be interesting. And then Melissa just responds of like, hey, you gave me the job. I finished your dish. I'm sorry it didn't work out.
Not a minute before we saw Kevin say, I'm not going to throw anyone under the bus. We saw Karen actively do it. And that's rough. Like, it's tough. I'm not going to fault Karen for that. But like, this is what is Restaurant Wars. Like, it creates this conflict. And I understand Haley and Emily, especially, and you're not certainly not alone. I know a lot of people in the audience are this way. The stress of this episode is not why we watch Top Chef. Like, it is not enjoyable to see this play out. There's probably a way to do it better. I'm just not sure that the show has ever really figured it out. And it's pretty crazy to go back and watch previous seasons, Restaurant Wars. Some of them are very low stress. Like, they're just not like this one was. This one was a nightmare, and it was a nightmare because of the chef talent level. I don't remember. Does anyone remember what Restaurant Wars was like in the first All-Star season?
No.
Well, Fabio was there, so he just crushed everything. I feel like it was a pretty unbalanced showing in All-Stars 1.
Yeah, I believe it was, I'm trying to remember who the teams were.
It was Dale and Fabio, and then I can't remember anything else.
Well, because I think they did it at 10, I believe, instead of 8. So it was, like, it was Carla, Dale Talday, Fabio, Richard Blaze, and Trey versus Angelo, Antonia, Marcel, Mike Isabella, and Tiffany. That's where Marcel went home before, you know, years before he would decry Brian Mullarky as being very annoying.
That feels unbalanced to me.
It sucks. I think the structure of the challenge sucks this season. And I think, sadly, one of the two people in the hot seat understands how to navigate this particular challenge to keep himself alive in the game. And the other one did a bad job recognizing, like, what was at stake in the structure of the challenge.
Well, we saw the quote between the two captains there at the beginning of the episode where Kevin said, I'd rather go out fighting for victory than playing it safe. And I guess my question is, did Gregory play it safe in light of what you just said, Josh? You basically all but said that he understood the structure of the challenge.
Smart. I think he played it smart. I don't know if he played it safe, and he played it safe, but I think he also played it smart.
Yeah,
I think
he worked smarter, not harder.
Yeah, I think he got what had to happen. He understood it. And, you know, going for like the big move or wanting like everybody else to like express themselves as chefs is a noble feeling. But I think, as we see, it's decidedly the wrong approach for the structure of this challenge. And the structure of the challenge is not Kevin's fault. You know, the approach that he takes is just the wrong approach given the structure of the challenge.
Yeah, I think and Antonio pointed out, like, each season we talk about, oh, how could they make Restaurant Wars better? And I think that the short answer is always, don't introduce the twist you just introduced. You know, don't introduce the pitch round. Don't do it when there's 12 chefs. Don't introduce two courses.
Twists. Nothing. Yeah. Just let it be.
It makes me, again, with the goldfish brain, have a hard time remembering. It's like, would I enjoy Restaurant Wars more if it was just old fashioned Restaurant Wars versus
did you like it 3 seasons ago during Top Chef Charleston?
This is why he says goldfish brain. He has no idea.
I have no idea.
I don't remember either. Well, I remember that one we didn't like, but it wasn't because of the actual structure. It was because of the chefs, because that was the big John Tesar versus Katsuji showdown. Yeah. So, I mean, I think whether it comes down to the structure or the chefs, it's just going to be a little, you're always going to be rolling the dice with this, but I guess I would rather them have just go with a very simplistic structure, especially for an All-Star season. You know, this has been talked about a lot in returning player reality television these days, of just keep to a simple structure and let the contestants do what they want to with the format. Yes, it might lead to uncomfortable moments like we saw with Karen and Melissa, but I would rather be decrying the choices that these chefs made rather than saying it sucks that Kevin was kind of boxed into a corner due to winning the previous challenge. And as a result, he failed mostly because of that.
I hate to say this. Are they going to, is next season's Restaurant Wars going to be them saying, chefs in this industry, we've undergone a lot of change in the last couple of years. For your Restaurant Wars challenge, I'll take out.
No, Antonio, please don't.
If we say it, maybe they won't do it. Is that a thing?
We're very influential. Yes. We're very influential.
This was, I mean, this one, for whatever reason, they both decided to do Family Style. And there was commentary about how there were no rules for Restaurant Wars this year. And they were just allowed to do whatever they wanted. I guess I wasn't familiar with there being, I guess they sometimes specify the number of courses you need to prepare or things like that.
And like how many dishes in each course you need to have.
I didn't realize that Gregory's was going to be Family Style until partway through the episode, where I was like, I had thought going into it that, oh, because Kevin's going to do Family Style, Gregory isn't, that's going to be a major difference. But then I think partway through the episode, they directly referenced that Gregory was going to as well. I was like, oh, that's interesting. So both are doing that. There's no dim sum cart. Despite my wishes,
that would have been incredible.
Yeah,
that
and
a nightmare considering what we saw, like a dim sum cart,
a dilly bean cart just full of all the fix-ins that they have to schlep out to everybody.
A fix-ins cart.
Leanne would have run over a server with it, and Kevin would have run over Melissa with it.
A hit and run with Leanne dim sum cart.
I do want to see next season. It's like the worst two concepts are the ones you have to create. Let's make that happen.
I like that idea. Actually, it's probably better than what we had.
Yeah.
But I guess the good news, the bright side to all this, and, you know, I think we talked about this last week as well, of like this is sort of theorized all the way back in. I think this eliminating Kevin here is probably the biggest person that's been eliminated in a Restaurant Wars since Kristen Kish, all the way back in season 10. Some might say the most controversial Restaurant Wars in history. Some theorize that maybe a reason why they did that, why they felt the leverage to eliminate a front runner there, is because of the concept of Last Chance Kitchen. And you can imagine that that at least was partially dinging off in Tom Colicchio's head, right? Of like, hell, Kevin, if Kevin gets eliminated here, he's going to have a hell of a time in Last Chance Kitchen coming back here. And I mean, I will flat out say I am not spoiled in the least, but I think Kevin's are returning from Last Chance Kitchen. I think dollars to donuts, it's absolutely happening.
Yeah, unless we send Melissa or Gregory out before then, I it seems likely to me as well. And I've always been pro Last Chance Kitchen, but when it comes to the idea that there is an incentive for them to make their web show more compelling by sending more compelling characters to Last Chance Kitchen when all things are equal, or that they don't see the real negative in this challenge design because you still get to keep the chef around if you want, that's a problem. And I hope that that does not enter into the calculus of who goes home, Mike, as you're saying, but it you certainly would be foolish not to think that they have more than one TV show to make. They're making a web show, and the web show needs to be as compelling as possible. And one of the ways you do that is you throw a really compelling chef in there. On an all-star season, it's always going to be loaded.
But. That's what I was going to say.
Yeah.
That last point is like, well, then, you know, if they don't have a compelling chef to send to Last Chance Kitchen, then they screwed up the first job.
Yeah.
Mm. I'm trying to remember, when do they come back?
Like, so this is the thing.
Yeah, let's go ahead, Mike.
Do you have any insight on this?
So, all right, so let's segue into Last Chance Kitchen.
We're going to spoil you.
No, that's all right. I saw the spreadsheet.
Kevin faces off against Nene, and their goal is to essentially, since Kevin's concept was that apparently was lauded as too feminine and too Miami Vice, was to, you know, create a restaurant off of a memory of his grandmother. Take a memory that was very formative to your experiences and make a dish out of it. And it was very close. Kevin harkens back to his time camping and makes some trout. Nene talks about a dish that she made with her grandmother that's usually braised chicken with pickled cabbage, but she goes for more of like a Southern style fry to it to reflect her New Orleans background. Apparently that was not a good gamble, but she's happy she did not burn anything. So unfortunately, Nene's time as a contender is over. But probably the most interesting thing from a futuristic perspective here is Tom tells Kevin there is one more battle before the finals begin, which is super interesting. Because we have seven people left. Usually the finals, which we usually constitute the finals as when they go to their secondary location. Like the finals is not the final episode. It's usually like your final 5-4-3-2, etc. The finals obviously are going to be in Italy. I'm sure we'll talk about the super teaser that they did for the episode for the rest of the season later on, but they mentioned that. So it looks like we have seven chefs right now left in the game. We're going to have somebody get eliminated. And then I guess with six, they're going to Italy, or maybe they do one more elimination before going to Italy, and then someone rejoins them, probably Kevin, and they're back up to six in Italy. I'm not entirely sure, but it was an interesting little tidbit that got thrown out there.
Unless there's like a double elimination, or they pause Last Chance Kitchen until it gets stocked with three or four people.
My heart can't take another double elimination.
I think it's a devil elimination.
Devil elimination.
Devil's advocate.
Well, I guess if we want to extrapolate a bit on the super teaser, so it looks like we have at least two challenges left in LA. Next week, they're going to summer camp. They're doing something there, and then apparently they're going to the Olympic and the one of the Olympic stadiums. And then I guess they're going to Italy after that. So I guess I could see like two more chefs get eliminated. So we have two more LCKs before like a final comeback round where one person flies over and meets the rest of them in Italy. So I guess that's sort of what we're looking at so far with the rest of the season. But yeah, it was just some sort of weird thing that ADR Tom threw in at the last second at the end of LCK this week.
He said there's one more Last Chance Kitchen battle.
One more battle before the finals begin. So I guess the finals could count like the final LCK battle. But okay. Yeah,
it could be like it's weird Carter or whatever.
It was strange because they cleared house, right? Like everyone from the peanut gallery was sent home, except for Eric, which was I thought was a strange decision. I thought they only did that with like the return when we had like the alumni in LCK in the couple seasons.
Did they not reset it last season too?
I can't remember.
I'm having a hard time remembering season by season, but they reset it the year that Marcel and Jen and
yeah, that was season 15, and then season 16 after Brother left. You know what happened? The alumni, so Carrie and Jim's and Brother all left, but I'm pretty sure all the newbie chefs still stayed in the peanut gallery.
Right.
So this time they just cleaned house. So
Because they have like their other endeavors to get back.
Sure.
Right. Joe Sasto, Angelo, Jamie, Lisa, you know.
Is this the Mambo number five that you're singing, Mike?
Yeah, exactly.
Sasto, Angela, Jamie, and Lisa.
Well, those five will not be dancing anymore because they are out of the peanut gallery. But it was a little sad to have Eric just walk out and sit on a stool all by himself.
Aww. But it led for a great moment when Kevin said, well, if I'm joining you over there, am I sitting on your lap or are you sitting on mine?
That's funny. Yeah. But it was a weird moment, though, because then, again, like, if you're resetting it here and then Tom says, oh, yeah, there's only going to be, like, two rounds left. It's just a weird sort of like part to cut off LCK, but I guess that also helps maybe then LCK naysayers in that there's only a couple of rounds and we're going to have a relatively pure like final six onward, it seems.
For peanut gang leader Jen Carroll, because we only got to see like one episode of that. Yeah. And that was awesome.
Josh, watch Last Chance Kitchen, if only because they show a couple of pictures of young Tom Colicchio.
Oh, yeah.
I think you'll appreciate it.
Great. No, I truly meant to. I'm all aboard LCK.
He tried to get us to last night, and then I was like, watching it.
What did you watch instead?
Screeners for something that I'm embargoed from speaking about.
Yeah, it was good.
Ooh.
Food-related, though.
Yeah. Guys, can we talk about summer camp next week and how upset Stephanie looks in the preview? Because that's probably what my reaction would have been to.
I'm assuming, like, are they like cooking for campers? Like, can they only use a campfire to cook?
Or is it a Bravo crossover with their new adult summer camp show?
Because I believe that actually premiered, if not is premiering, like next week. So I think that would make a lot of sense with like the synergy of it all.
I mean, I think you say it as a joke, Haley. I bet you're right.
Well, it's like last season, right? When they did the boat challenge, we're like, here comes below deck Southern guy here to coach you on what happens when your boat malfunctions. So
Haley,
I think
what have
it's
you
happening.
Done?
I can't wait until next week. Season when they do a crossover where they have to cater Stassi and Bo's wedding.
That's good.
Wait, there's someone named Stassi?
Oh yeah, Stassi Schroeder.
Yeah, she was also on Amazing Race Family Edition.
Like Stasi? Am I the only one that knows the other use of that?
Maybe. It sounds like it.
Okay. That's a bad name. Stasi. I hope that's not her name.
It's S. T-A-S-S-I. Her real name's like Anastasia. Oh,
well, there's an SS in there as well?
That's what you're referencing.
You know what? That actually is kind of a little fitting for her in some of her previous scandals.
Oh my God.
I'm picking up what you're putting down.
Yeah. We have digressed.
Mercifully, I'm not.
I just can't believe there's someone named Stassi. That's not a thing that we should be saying.
It's a, yeah.
Is there anything else you guys want to talk about of this episode, or should we move into what we have been making this week?
Well, I mean, I should just say, like, again,
no,
I think
Mike, that wasn't an invitation.
Okay. I didn't realize this was a rhetorical question that he was posing to the panel. The question.
We're now at the rhetorical Q&A.
All right, hold on one sec. Let me just remove Mike from the stream real quick.
All right, Mike's waiting to see what actually happened.
Yeah. He did it before. Like,
I'm not
going to
do it.
I'll start by reading the synopsis for Cabin Fever next week. The chefs head to the mountains a few hours outside of Los Angeles to go to summer camp, where they are challenged to an outdoor grilling quickfire for Padma and Top Chef Kentucky winner Kelsey Bernard Clark. Before the sun rises, the chefs get to work on an upscale brunch buffet for 200 moms vacationing at the camp using a very limited stock pantry. They'll take more than s'mores and a round of kumbayas to impress the moms, the judges, Tom, Padma, and Gail, and guest judge, Top Chef Charleston winner Brooke Williamson.
Yay.
Yeah.
That's the only thing to say.
Yeah, it's the only part I liked. I'm glad Kevin does not have to subject himself to this nonsense. This malarkey.
The written descriptions of the episodes are always worse than the episodes themselves. I remain positive, and I look forward to next week's show.
Wow.
That's what I'll say.
I
think it's safe to say that the six of us were not terribly pleased with this episode for a myriad of reasons. That being said, I've still been loving this season personally. Like, I love the people, maybe in spite of some of the challenges that are thrown their way. And that being said, I'm excited to move forward. I'm also maybe moving forward positively with the expectation that Kevin's going to come back. So it's not like he's completely eliminated from the game. So from that perspective, I think there's still a lot of great people on here. Gregory, I think, just cemented himself as one of the all-time Top Chef contestants of ever with that performance that he put in at Restaurant Wars. So, I mean, no matter what they may, how many moms they may be cooking for, hopefully not 1 million moms, but, you know, no matter who they may be cooking for, I'm very excited about this cast, even if the landmark episode of this season was less than pleasing, in my opinion.
I do this every season of Top Chef. I compare it to the Snatch Game episode of Drag Race, mm-hmm. Because I always feel like it's the hallmark episode of the season, and it never is as good as we want it to be.
Yeah.
Agreed.
Maybe the chefs should do Snatch Game. Maybe that's the way to fix
that
this.
I want to see, and then have the drag queens do restaurant wars.
Yes.
Drag brunch restaurant wars, man.
Yeah, that could
Let's
work.
Do it.
Because then I'm expecting a scene out of like Mrs. Doubtfire where like one of them gets their bra on fire.
Hello. Puts pancake batter all over their face. Yeah.
Exactly.
The good ideas, one and all.
To run by fruiting.
that's the quick fire.
Yeah.
So what else have you guys been up to?
Well, just, you know, the
Emily, you made burgers last night.
Cosmic dread.
They actually didn't turn out great.
Oh no.
Oh no, why?
Because I was worried that I undercooked them, even though we love a medium rare in this household. And then Josh was on a phone call, so I tried to keep everything warm while that was happening, and I just cooked too long.
That's fine. They were great.
They were fine.
What kind of meat blend did you use, if any? What was your meat mix?
Just ground beef.
Just ground beef.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Ground beef.
Just beans, take beans, a hunk of beef, beans throw and it in a pan, beef. And that's
a
burger.
That's what we did.
Yeah.
How did you try to keep them warm? I'm imagining like a pizza shop, like, heat lamp, but I'm assuming you don't have that.
I seared them on the stove in a cast iron, then I put it in the oven to just cook it for like another 2 minutes or so. Pulled it out and it still looked really juicy and bloody, so I was like, you know what I'll do? I'll just put it on low on the back burner and put the top over it. And that's what happened. I steamed them.
Steamed ham.
Emily took it very, very personally, but we made four burgers and all four of them are now gone. And not because they've been thrown away, except to be thrown away into the pits of our stomach.
I made my own buns too.
You know, so. I think you're being harsh on yourself. Yeah.
Burger baps. You made your own buns. I like that.
Emily also like very casually made an incredible vegetable curry yesterday and like didn't even like mention it. It was freaking delicious. So like
you were taking a nap and
I was. I took a 2-hour nap. It was great. And the cat slept with me and it was really great. I made breakfast tacos yesterday.
Oh, nice.
That Emily couldn't eat because they had eggs. We had eggs from a CSA. And I made breakfast tacos with a salsa verde that we'd had left over from takeout. Oddly, I put some Parmesan cheese on them.
Yeah, I don't love that part.
But it was actually really, 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 really super good. And I ate them inside of like 2 minutes and it was the best.
What's the protein in a breakfast taco? Is it sausage?
It was just egg. It was egg. It was egg, salsa verde, some Parmesan, which is so strange. And I actually gave it
especially
a spritz of that
cheddar,
that like, Trader Joe's everything bagel seasoning.
Yeah, so we finally
got and some hot sauce too. It was really, really good.
We got some this week and we had some avocado toast and you were truly right that it was a game changer.
I told you. It's the best.
Like who knew? Just throw in some extra salt and like an assortment of seeds onto it and like
It's the real deal. As well, I give credit to Zach Brooks for this. Zach Brooks is the person who I saw first pumping up the Trader Joe's everything seasoning. And he said avocado toast game changer. And so I followed his lead and I don't eat avocado toast any other way. Maybe like a little spritz of citrus spritz.
No.
on top of there.
Vocal warm-ups are from before the podcast.
Spritz of sitch. That's what I cooked.
I made a pork chop. I want to redeem myself.
Emily made a ridiculous pork chop.
Yeah. With what was this? Wheat berries?
Wheat berries and greens of some kind and an apple turnip puree.
An apple parsnip puree.
Apple parsnip puree. This is very great.
We've been working our way through the freezer a little bit because we got really freaked out, obviously, at the beginning, which I think most people did. And we stockpiled like there was no tomorrow. And now we're like, okay, maybe we should eat some of the things we prepared rather than continuously, you know, hoarding more and more groceries and just cooking what we have that's fresh. So we, you know, broke into some of the dumplings that I had shaped and made off of that pork shoulder that I cooked a few weeks ago
that
had been frozen. So like that was really tasty. I don't know. This week's been all about like hacks.
Yeah.
We had tortillas that I took out and we turned into chips.
I made tortilla chips.
Yeah.
That was me.
Made tortilla chips.
That was me. I forgot that I did that.
Yeah. I said, this sounds like a Josh Wiggler job, and you thought
I was a little offended by it, but now I'm glad that you assigned it to me. Just put oil on both sides of the tortilla, stack up a butt ton of tortillas, chop them up into tortilla chip shapes, put them onto the baking sheet, you stick them in the oven for what was the degree that we put it in, Emily?
375.
375, and then you take them out and you rotate them.
To say that you put salt
and you salt them. You salt them, and then you rotate them, and then you take them out, and you got tortilla chips.
I love that you, as a married couple, refer to each other as your like first and last name.
Yeah, Emily Fox, everybody, ladies and gentlemen, Emily Fox over here.
In all my years on this earth, today is the day I realized that tortilla chips come from tortillas.
Yeah.
Kurt, tortilla chips are like the teeth skin of bread.
Yeah, really. True.
Did you think that tortillas were assembled versions of tortilla chips?
I don't know.
Yeah, which do you think first?
I'm still trying to process that baby carrots aren't just like stop short of growth. But they're made from larger carrots.
Yep.
It's something I've never given any thought to. And I'm like, that makes a complete sense now.
Well, if it makes you feel any better, Josh was like, so the tortillas we're using right now, these are flour. And I was like, no, they're corn tortillas, which is why we're making corn tortilla chips.
You would never. Why are you dragging me? Tortillas. There's no call for
I'm
this.
I'm trying to make Kurt feel better.
Yeah, flour tortilla chips.
Oh, no, I fully embrace my stupidity.
Right, you're just dragging me unnecessarily. All right, well, let's move on from us then. We're going to mute the mic. We're going to have a little conversation.
Wow, this was my mixology week. In quarantine, I've crafted a couple different not quite quarantinis, but I went with I like the sweet drinks, and so I had some watermelon vodka and blueberry lemonade, which was a fun combination. But my personal favorite, peach schnapps and limeade.
Hey,
I'm like,
that's good, actually.
It's so refreshing. And in terms of food, it's not been a big cooking week for me. On Survivor Wednesday, I did takeout from a local Brazilian barbecue place.
Ooh.
And I got the.
Now, how does that work? Because like you usually stop and
every
go.
2 minutes they're knocking at my door with a skewer.
Like, put like meat down in or Tupperware.
You stay on the phone with them and like however as they're preparing the meal, and then you tell them when to stop.
That's the one disappointing part of it is like I'm a big proponent of the all you can eat.
Yeah.
But I got the Brazilian, it's the picanha, picanha. I think it's the Brazilian cut of steak. It's kind of fatty. I got that. It came with. It's interesting. Like. Through Grubhub, you got to order one side, but through DoorDash, you got to order two sides. But it was 10 ounces on Grubhub and 8 ounces on. Anyway, I went with a Caesar salad and then these bacon wrapped blue cheese and brie stuffed dates, which were amazing. And I actually only ate about 2/3 of the.
Devil's on horseback, baby.
Yes. I only ate about 2/3 of the steak. And then the next day, I diced up the steak and I put it in a ramen. And soft boiled a couple eggs and threw those in.
Oh, nice. I saw that. Yeah, that looked really good.
I'm like a pro when it comes to soft boiling eggs. It's like the third time I've done it, and it's perfect every time. It's like the one thing I'm proud of is I can perfectly soft boil an egg. I know it's
now,
not,
Kurt, you realize that soft boiled eggs come from regular eggs that you get at the grocery store.
No, they sold me separate eggs for soft boiling. No, I'm kidding.
I believed it for a minute.
They sell you some magic beans too.
Yeah, some magic beans for my ground pork, my beef and ground was it beans and ground beef or magic beans and ground beef. But yeah, which I'll be making today. Actually, I bought some Kobe beef that I'm going to use to make the beans and ground beef.
Oh yeah.
So I'm it's the perfect example of the the Last Chance Kitchen. Take something you grew up with. And then put a modern twist on it. So it was always kind of basic beans and ground beef, but now I'm using Kobe beef. I'm using a variety of spices that you don't find in most Midwestern households.
Trader Joe's everything seasoning.
If I had it, I would honestly probably add sriracha. I've got sriracha. And I've got like again that weird everything sauce from Crystal Farms, which it doesn't taste like an everything bagel, so I don't know what it's supposed to be. Actually. Continue on. I'm going to go get it from the fridge because I'm curious. I've never actually read the label.
Okay. All right. Sure. Why not? Why the hell not?
While we're talking labels at the point.
While we're talking about food, this feels like an opportunity because I talked about the light that was glowing on Antonio earlier that was really only going to translate to people watching the video, i.e. us. Mike, you keep reaching for a beverage and I keep meaning to ask you, what's the beverage that you're going for?
This?
Yeah. What is that?
It's water.
It's a water bottle.
Water bottle. Oh.
It's okay. Just a very, it's like, it's
I thought it was
he's
like
a,
some
a fancy
of,
lad.
I thought it was some sort of like thing that you'd gotten that was like a sweet milk.
Ew. So you would think that
I don't know. I didn't see. You kept going for it quickly. I thought maybe
just,
it was
just to clarify. You thought I've been just throwing back sweet milk over the course of our hour and a half podcast.
Yes, correct. Yeah, I did. And I kept wanting to ask, and I was like,
my constitution is very strong. Otherwise, I would be just retching up sweet milk over the course of this podcast.
Your water bottle is like shaped in like a bottle that you'd get
like a milk jug. Yeah, like the milkman would bring around in the 50s.
Yeah, that's what I thought. I thought you had the sweet milk.
So it's everything aioli. You would see this on the shelf and you would think everything bagel. We called this everything aioli because you can put it on everything.
False advertising. False advertising.
Oh, Kurt's losing it. We've lost Kurt. Oh, Kurt's
gone.
Kurt's going nuts.
Oh my god.
Do you think you could put that on like your homemade tortilla chips?
Yeah.
That you just discovered?
Yeah, Kurt, you've got a project, my friend.
Yeah, perfect for homemade tortilla chips.
Yeah.
Great nachos.
This is the worst marketing ever. Oh my god.
Yeah, Kurt Clark. Oh man.
Whoa. That really is a terrible name for a product though. Like it's even worse than what was it? Sunny's lemon ginger sauce.
Oh, yeah. Mike Bloom's sweet milk.
It's all in there. I didn't ketchup, pickle, mustard, onion, like mayo, chili.
I hope there's mayo in there.
Yeah, because the aioli, yeah. But it's not at all. It's like special sauce for a Big Mac. It's not. Yeah. I was like, but this does, everything I've been putting this on, I'm like, this does not taste like an everything bagel.
And, oh my God.
And I now see why. I'm very disappointed. Notice it's like a third of the way gone too, and I'm just reading the label now.
This has been a tough day for Kurt Clark.
I know. My new favorite song is watching Kurt Clark discover life.
And it's like I'm 40% of the way through it, and I'm just now realizing I can be putting this on everything, apparently.
Hey, you screwed up.
Well,
you're making your famous beef and ground beef and beans tonight. Yeah. Throw that everything sauce on.
Yeah, see what happens.
There we go. And I did get a meal kit this week, which will be the Marley Spoon, the Martha Stewart meal kit.
Ooh.
So I know there's like some caramel chicken, some like Thai lettuce wraps, and a spaghetti dish. So that'll be this week.
Nice.
And I'll be putting this freaking sauce on everything. So.
Who else did things?
This week, what did I make? I made a nice little carrot coconut soup. It was super easy, and it kind of just used a bunch of stuff I had around.
Sounds refreshing.
It was really good, and it was pretty hearty because I put potatoes in it. It was delicious. So I did put the recipe up on my blog just because it was pretty easy. So you can check that out at strongpigs.ca if you want.
And that was vegan, right?
It was, yeah.
Nice.
It was nice and creamy because of the coconut milk. I love adding coconut milk to anything. It just gives like a really nice texture. And it's not overly coconutty flavory. So if that is something that makes you nervous, don't worry about it.
Better sweet milks out there.
Mm. Yeah.
Sweet coconut milk.
Mike's just knocking that back.
Listen, if I'm on island time, like Brian Mullarky said he was, I'm slugging back sweet coconut milks in this carafe.
Yeah. Doesn't that look like that looks
it looks like a milk bottle.
That's what I'm saying.
It's like a classic milk bottle.
It's huge.
Kurt, take your requisite screenshot right now. Mike, can you pose with that real quick? Just I want people to be able to see. Oh my God. Yes. Yeah. And that's tropical.
No, it's like a stainless steel water bottle, and Angela hates it because every time I knock it over, and I knock it over plenty because I'm Mike Bloom, it it's like a nice big noise to let you know that it's here. My journey around the Pan-Asian culinary scene has continued. We moved on from bibimbap into tacos. Now we're trying to find like some nice Asian tacos.
Just ask Brian Mullarky.
Yeah, exactly. Come to my barbecue truck.
We found the donkey. Now we're going for the dragon. We're going to have some tonight as well. But that's been fun. You know, it's sort of taking a different look at that, different use for the same meats that we're using in all these other different dishes.
Korean tacos are like one of my top five things to go for on like any sort of restaurant or menu. Like just if that's an option, that's where I'm going to go.
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
What about you, Antonio?
I'm having some internet issues. I don't know if you can hear me, but
no,
I haven't done anything anyway. Because of the internet issues, just been takeout primarily, trying to support some local restaurants here and continuing to do that. So that's been mainly the focus here the last week. Probably we'll get into some pasta this weekend at some point for sure.
Pasta.
I actually, after this podcast, we're going on for like a nice little tour around Niagara. We placed a bunch of orders this week, so we're going to go pick them all up. So to my favorite winery, Small Talk in Niagara on the Lake. We put a nice order in there. I'm going to try and socially distance, wave hi to my grandmother who is staying with my aunt there. And then we are going to pick up like a farmer's box in Niagara Falls for our vegetables. And then we are heading to Fort Erie. Because I'm Canadian, I have a hard time judging who is famous in Canada and America or just like solely Canada. And there's a celebrity chef, Maddie Matheson, who
no idea.
You know who he is.
Do I?
Yeah. He's on like all the Vice stuff.
You wouldn't, if you saw him, you would know.
The guy that's really loud and huge.
A lot of tattoos. He's actually he's from
Niagara. It looks like a combination of Zeke Smith and John Gemberling.
Wow.
He's from Niagara. And he's doing these takeout dinners in Niagara. It's a lot of meat and stuff. And he is donating a portion of proceeds to that to a local women's shelter. So we have that on the docket for this evening for dinner. And we're really excited.
He is covered in tattoos.
Yeah, like a lot of tattoos.
What photos are you looking at?
There's one of him standing on the beach. Okay. There's also one where he's like posing shirtless, and he is like, no joke, his entire body is covered in tattoos. I admire the constitution of that man. He must drink sweet milk like a champion.
Mm.
Does a body good.
Yeah.
Now I want like a Vietnamese coffee.
Okay.
Oh, those are good.
Milk in it. Yeah.
Ooh, those are really good.
Condensed milk.
Thai iced tea.
Haley. Yeah. I love Thai iced tea.
Haley. Haley, did you say you had an email? Was there an email?
I do believe we did receive an email.
Didn't you say there was an email?
There is. Let me just open that one up. Okay. So you can send your questions, if you have them, to either downthehatch@postshowrecaps.com. That's easier to remember for some people.
Yep.
Or you can email the two bachelorwrapup@gmail.com. Sorry for sending these to you instead of Haley. It's okay, Andrew. It's fine. I won't take it personally. It did get to me eventually.
Mm-hmm.
It's an easier email to remember. Anyhow, last week I was ragging on Gregory's team, and I gotta say, I am impressed and I am eating my words. I loved how he took control of the team and made them go slower so he could taste everything. He got the best guy for front of house, and he wasn't afraid to adjust on the fly when Leanne was melting down. I still think Kevin's team is more talented, but I was surprised how stubborn Kevin was not to adjust things when he seems to be very thoughtful about those kinds of things. It almost seemed like Melissa and Brian knew it was a bad idea to do so much. But I wonder if they tried to push back and Kevin wouldn't relent, or they just stayed quiet and let him sing. Anyway, that's all I got. You guys are killing it in all aspects of the podcasting. Andrew. Well, thank except you, Andrew. The broadcasting it live, but
it's live to us.
Yes.
I know. I washed my hair for this and everything.
I'm sorry. It's my fault.
I put on concealer.
It's my fault.
So did I.
I didn't fix my eyebrows up, though. So
I'm so sorry.
Everyone looks beautiful today and every day.
Well, what else? Is that it? Have we reached a natural stopping point?
Well, I guess I'll say as a bit of a plug, you know, to answer to, if we want to get the answer for Andrew's question as to what the team dynamic was like on Team Kevin, hopefully I should have an opportunity to talk with him at some point for parade.com. I do have my interview with Eric that went out, I believe, shortly after we recorded. So check that out. I'll be super intrigued to hear from Kevin, even though, again, I do not think this is his last time cooking in the Top Chef kitchen proper. I'm sure he has a lot of thoughts about what happened on that particular day. So I'll be sure to pimp it out once it ends up falling into my lap.
Wow. Some words.
And I am obviously doing the Bachelor Listen to Your Heart wrap up over on this very network. But I also guest it on a podcast that should be out on Wednesday on the Hallmarkies podcast, talking about the Hallmark movie Like Cats and Dogs, starring Wyatt Nash, aka Matt Elrod from Survivor Redemption Island. So that should be up Wednesday.
No one's ever called him Melrod, I don't
think. For a reason, yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't sound as good as Wyatt Nash.
Or Wash.
Wash. Wash. the podcast should be called Hall Malarkeys.
The Hall Malarkey channel.
I'll pitch that to them, but I don't think they're gonna go for it. It's I think the they're doing okay without that name.
Reconceive all the Hallmark movies with Brian Malarkey.
And the movie of Shrek.
Yeah.
Can we do a deep fake of Brian Malarkey in famous movies?
Oh man, maybe. Antonio just made a face, so he's got some ideas for it.
I just heard Malarkey deep fake. I got concerned.
Yeah.
I don't know what Mike's doing with that sweet milk.
We're doing a sweet milk deep dive on the Lost Down the Hatch podcast this past week.
But sweet milk deep dive on sour water.
It's actually one of
the shorter podcasts we've ever done, and it features, I guess, the Brian Malarkey of noises, in that it's the most annoying noise you'll probably ever hear in quite some time. The point where it made Emily Fox freak out as she was secondhandedly watching the episode.
Yeah, so you were like, "What are you watching?" I was like, "I'm watching Lost." Right? Can you turn it down? It's like, I'm sorry.
Oh, that's what that was.
That's what that was. So we're doing that over at Post Show Recaps, Killing Eve podcast, myself and Jessica Lease, and the Everything is Super Marvel Cinematic Universe rewatch reaches the Avengers this week. Very excited.
Everything Aioli is not super.
Everything Aioli is bad. Everything Aioli is unsuper. Oh, so that's what's up. That's what's up on the Post Show. So I think that's it, unless anyone else has anything to be like, hey, I did that.
No, so Survivor's finishing up. We do Survivor stuff over the next couple of weeks. So check all that out.
I heard a rumor.
There's a rumor.
Weird. So where can people find you on Twitter and or Instagram and or Untapped, friend?
I'm still Kurt Clark with two C's on all those platforms. Thanks to those of you who joined me in my very boring streaming of Red Dead Redemption 2 on Twitch. Lots of horse riding. That's it.
I'm at Round Howard, everywhere you can find him. And Emily is at Emlet, everywhere you can find her.
That's right.
It's like omelet, but with an E.
Yeah. Yes.
Everywhere you look, there's a Mike Bloom type.
And Antonio is AC Mazzaro.
Choosing his one arm.
Yeah, he's just waiting for us to do the work.
H-strong underscore for Haley.
Holla. Not holla.
Oh,
did I say that right?
Yeah, you did. Okay. A little like overpronounced, but
sorry.
I'd rather you overcompensate than undercompensate when it comes to pronunciations.
Yeah. H-strong underscore strongtakes.ca. We love you so much. Text us, beep us if you want to reach us. XOXO, Gossip Haley, pack your knives and go. Bye.
Bye.